Welcome to the No Illusions podcast for March 15th, 2011. My name is Cameron Riley. You're listening to the Podcast Network. Well, what a week it has been. Obviously, earthquakes, tsunamis, and nuclear power plant explosions in Japan. Good place to start. The mainstream media has been kicking up a huge fuss around the dangers of the explosions in the nuclear plants in Japan, and I guess that's reasonable. We're all concerned about potential radiation escaping and obviously the lives of the people in Japan, the workers in the Fukushima plants and the other nuclear plants around Japan. But you know, there seems to be quite a bit of hysteria in the mainstream media and also in social media and Twitter and Facebook around the danger presented by the explosion at these plants. And for an alternative perspective, I refer you to the blog of my friend Rod Adams. Rod's been doing a podcast on TPN for 5 or 6 years called The Atomic Show. He writes an excellent blog called Atomic Insights, atomicinsights.com and atomicinsights.blogspot.com. And Rod's an atomic energy activist, the founder of Adams Atomic Engines. He's worked in nuclear submarines and around nuclear energy all of his life. I believe his son is also a nuclear engineer and a nuclear submarine. And Rod's obviously pro-nuclear and, you know, has made the point to me many times in the past that the number of people killed directly and indirectly by nuclear accidents over the last 50 years is absolutely dwarfed by the amount of people killed directly and indirectly by the fossil fuels industry, not only by explosions at coal and gas and oil refineries that happen every year, but also the pollution that they kick out into the atmosphere and the damage that that does to humans, to animals, to the environment in general. So it's worth thinking about why there's so much hysteria around these accidents at nuclear plants and why the mainstream media gets so hysterical about them and whether or not there is perhaps another agenda. Rod and I have spoken about this on this show in the past and on his show. You know, one possibility is that, you know, the mainstream media is obviously closely aligned with big energy, particularly the oil, the coal, the gas industries. There's a lot of crossover between the investors of those businesses and the investors in the big mainstream corporate media businesses. So, you know, it's worth considering that there may be other agendas here for kicking up the hysteria a few notches whenever there's an accident at somewhere like Japan. Now, whoops, my phone started to ring. I just needed to grab that. It was my kids. Now, I'm not suggesting that we shouldn't be concerned, but I think we should just think about what ulterior motives there might be for the level of hysteria, and we should take that into account when we're reading the news. And check out Rod's blog, atomicinsights.blogspot.com. I'm going to try and get him on the show in the next few days, and we might do an entire show about the dangers of nuclear energy versus the dangers of fossil fuels. Sticking with atomics, moving slightly left though, read an interesting article in PopSci today called Atomtronics, or Atoms Spun by Laser Beams Could Replace Electronics. A new type of circuit involving a whirling donut of super cold gas could lead to the world's first atomtronic devices, potentially more powerful than electronics or spintronics, according to researchers. It probably won't be powering your next smartphone, however. It involves laser beams, and who doesn't like something that involves laser beams, and super cold temperatures a few billionths of a degree above absolute zero. Atomtronics involves supercooling atoms to form Bose-Einstein condensates, which could theoretically be used to create analogs to electrons, diodes, and transistors. The atoms in the condensate flow as a current which can be switched on and off like a normal circuit. Researchers at the Joint Quantum Institute in Maryland suspended sodium atoms in a magnetic field and cooled them down, then trapped them in a pair of crossed laser beams, as Science News explains. They further cooled the atoms to a few billionths of a degree above absolute zero, resulting in a Bose-Einstein condensate. The atoms began to act as one quantum particle. Researchers flattened it into a donut-shaped ring with a radius of about 20 micrometers. Another set of lasers then zapped the ring to start it spinning. Because the condensate acts as one unit, it spins without friction, meaning it could theoretically spin forever. Now, I thought that was against the laws of physics, but apparently not. In this case, it only lasted about 40 seconds, the lifetime of the condensate. The researchers say the method could be used to build a new type of rotation sensor. Atomtronics uses atoms in strange quantum states to power devices or computer memory. This is different from spintronics, which stores information based on the spin of individual electrons, allowing each one to store two bits of data instead of one. Computer scientists and particle physicists have made several advances in these fields in the past several months. Last fall, a University of Utah team figured out how to store quantum data in the nuclei of phosphorus atoms in a step towards creating quantum memory. In August, Ohio State researchers built and tested the first spintronic memory device. Now, this is interesting to me because I'm often involved in discussions and I've been involved in a debate with some people on Twitter recently about whether or not Moore's Law is likely to continue over the next 3, 4, 5 decades. And one of the things that people often point to is the current state of chip technology and how we're going to reach limits with how small we can make gates, etc., over the next 10 years. But there's obviously a lot of research being done on alternative forms of computing. We hear about quantum computing all the time, but this atomtronics is something that's new to me as a field of theoretics, if nothing else. You know, and one of the reasons I find this interesting is we have to sort of think about what the implications of another couple of decades of Moore's Law are to us as a species. And, you know, one of the debates I was having with people on Twitter recently, they were saying, oh, yes, but back in the 50s, they were predicting we'd all be flying around in UFOs right now when we're not, and we'd all be flying around in jets and cars or have jetpacks, etc. And therefore, as I understand it, the argument is predicting the singularity is ridiculous. The future won't look anything like we think it will. Although, of course, the whole theory of the singularity is things are going to change so dramatically we can't predict them. And if, in fact, if you go back to the 50s and you try to predict iPhones and the internet and YouTube and Twitter and iPads, I suspect that a lot of people would have thought you were absolutely crazy. We have built a future that was inconceivable to all but perhaps a tiny fraction of humanity 50, 60 years ago. But here's the big difference, I think, between some of those 50s sci-fi predictions of us all living on the moon and, you know, the future of AI and nanotech that infer the approaching technological singularity. And I think it has to do with economic motivation. I mean, the truth is we actually do have the ability to travel into space and to live on the moon today. We have humans that are living on the International Space Station. We have been to the moon. We have people that fly around in space shuttles from time to time. The thing that stopped more of us being able to do that is a question of economics. It's too expensive for most of us to you know, participate in those sorts of activities the way that they currently operate, using fossil fuels to blast off, etc. But also the money hasn't gone into continued research to improve our space technology for a whole variety of reasons. However, when you look at what's pushing ever growing increases in computing technology and things like nanotech that build off the back of that, they seem to have economics in their favor. I mean, it's hard to imagine that around the world we're going to stop investing in faster and faster computational technologies, or that we're going to stop investing in nanotech, because all of our industry, all of our capitalist forces are built on more and more effective computational power. So unless capitalism shuts down, or the whole idea of progress disappears in our society, I think it's reasonable to believe that over the next several decades, we're going to continue to invest heavily in these things. Of course, there's a question as to whether or not we'll actually break through some of these technological hurdles that we're facing, but there's so much research happening and so much incentive, you know, economic incentive for us to break through, and the breakthroughs don't seem to be prevented by any laws of physics as we understand them. It seems reasonable to me that we will continue to see a doubling of our computational power per dollar every couple of years for the next few decades, which means that the world that we're living in 30, 40 years from now, say by 2050, is going to be extremely different to how we live today. And the ability to have supercomputers running in our homes and integrated with our minds and our bodies seems very realistic to me. And of course, that's going to change who we are as a species, as computers have already changed. I mean, I can absolutely tell you that I'm a different person with an iPad under my arm than I am without an iPad. So Atomtronics, look that up. It's going to be an interesting field. Moving now to geopolitics. As you may have seen over the course of the last week, PJ Crowley, who was the State Department spokesperson for the White House, was forced to resign from his position because he spoke out publicly about the conditions of Bradley Manning being held in detention. He called Manning's detention ridiculous, counterproductive, and stupid, which forced President Obama to address those comments in a press conference. And he actually, Obama this is, defended the treatment of Manning. So then Crowley abruptly resigned under pressure from White House officials, apparently. So as Glenn Greenwald in Salon.com says, so in Barack Obama's administration, it's perfectly acceptable to abuse an American citizen in detention who's been convicted of nothing by consigning him to 23-hour-a-day solitary confinement, barring him from exercising in his cell, punitively imposing suicide watch restrictions on him against the recommendations of Briggs psychiatrists, and subjecting him to prolonged forced nudity designed to humiliate and degrade. But speaking out against that abuse is a firing offense. Good to know. Of course, Obama also gave basically presidential immunity to those involved during the Bush administration that instituted worldwide torture and illegal eavesdropping within the United States. While, and this is quoting from Greenwald again, while powerless individuals who blow the whistle on high-level wrongdoing and illegality are subjected to the most aggressive campaign of prosecution and persecution this country has ever seen. So protecting those who are abusing Manning while firing Crowley for condemning the abuse is perfectly consistent with the president's sense of justice. Greenwald goes on to say, remember when the Bush administration punished General Eric Shinseki for his public and prescient dissent on the Rumsfeld-Wolfowitz plan for Iraq, and all good Democrats thought that was so awful, such a terrible sign of the administration's refusal to tolerate any open debate. And then there was that time when Bush fired his White House economic advisor, Lawrence Lindsay, for publicly suggesting that the Iraq war might cost $100 billion, prompting similar cries of outrage from Democrats about how the GOP crushes internal debate and dissent. Obama's conduct seems quite far from the time during the campaign when Obama-fawning journalists like Times' Joe Klein were hailing him for wanting a team of rivals, and Obama was saying things like this, I don't want to have people who just agree with me. I want people who are continually pushing me out of my comfort zone. Of course, you don't hear Democrats speaking out against what's happening under the Obama administration today. And It just strikes me not only hypocritical of President Obama, which, you know, of course we should expect nothing less from a patsy for Goldman Sachs, as he has always appeared to me to be, but, you know, I take issue with the American public, the Democrats, the people that were in support of Obama becoming president, and their continued silence on the way that he's running the White House, the continual bombing of people in Iraq and Afghanistan. We heard on the news today how a cousin of Hamid Karzai, the president of Afghanistan, one of his cousins was supposedly shot by American troops accidentally in his house, supposedly accidentally, last week. And Karzai has continually, this is the president of Afghanistan, who supposedly had free and fair elections. The president is continually asking the United States to stop these house raids that they're doing in Afghanistan, but they don't give a shit. They're doing whatever the hell they like because they know that they're running things. You don't hear American Democrats speaking out as loudly or as forcefully or as constantly about America under Obama as they did under America under Bush, Cheney, Rumsfeld. It makes me wonder about the intellectual integrity of people who aren't willing to speak out forcefully just because they help the guy get elected. I think we have to be equally, if not more, angry about elected representatives when we voted for them and they fail than people we didn't vote for in the first place. Staying with geopolitics and the US, there's a great article in New Statesman from last week by John Pilger, renowned Australian investigative journalist living in England. He says, of all the recent revolts across the world, the most exciting is the insurrection of knowledge sparked by WikiLeaks. But even the liberal press is turning its back on Julian Assange. As the US and Britain look for an excuse to invade another oil-rich Arab country, the hypocrisy is familiar. While Colonel Gaddafi is delusional and blood-drenched, the authors of an invasion that killed 1 million Iraqis, who have sanctioned kidnap and torture in our name, are entirely sane, never blood-drenched, and once again the arbiters of stability. But something has changed. Reality is no longer what the powerful say it is. Of all the spectacular revolts across the world, the most exciting is the insurrection of knowledge sparked by WikiLeaks. This is not a new idea. In 1792, the revolutionary Tom Paine warned his readers in England that their government believed that people must be hoodwinked and held in superstitious ignorance by some bugbear or other. Paine's The Rights of Man was considered such a threat to elite control that a secret grand jury was ordered to charge him with a dangerous and treasonable conspiracy. Wisely, he sought refuge in France. The ordeal and courage of Tom Paine was cited by the Sydney Peace Foundation in its awarding of Australia's Human Rights Gold Medal to Julian Assange. Like Paine, Assange is a maverick who serves no system and is threatened by a secret grand jury, a malicious device long abandoned in England, but not in America. If extradited to the US, he is likely to disappear into the Kafkaesque world that produced the Guantanamo Bay nightmare and now accuses Bradley Manning, the alleged WikiLeaks whistleblower, of a capital crime. So this is a very long article. You should read it on New Statesman. The link will be in the show notes. But again, I mean, Pilger's exactly right. We see this spun out across the media and by government representatives in the US, in Australia, and in the UK, how Gaddafi's, a nutcase, and Ahmadinejad is a madman, etc., etc. And yet the absolute atrocities committed under the banner of Western democracies in the last decade in places like Iraq and Afghanistan just goes as being a matter of course. These are things that get justified on a daily basis, continue to be justified by Obama, by Gillard, by Cameron in the UK. And the mainstream media just goes along for the ride. We see very little condemnation or even inquiry by the mainstream media about why we continue with these policies. And again, where are the people's revolts in these countries? I mean, we're seeing small revolts, I guess, happening in the US now in places like Connecticut and in Wisconsin and in where's Michael Moore from? I can't remember. You know what I'm talking about? Michigan. Thank you, brain, for kicking into gear. There's been some protests happening there over the last few weeks, which is fantastic to see, but no serious protests in Australia yet. And we need to work out how do we motivate this fat, comfortable middle class to speak up and act up and do things to stop these atrocities happening in our name. Sticking with Australia for a minute, Ross Garnaut has spoken out again about the current science around climate change. Thursday last week, Ross Garnaut released the fifth update to his 2008 report on climate change, specifically tackling climate science. Professor Garnaut says new science since the 2007 International Panel on Climate Change Research has strengthened the position that the Earth is warming and that human emissions of greenhouse gases are the main cause. He also released specific data on temperature, sea level rises, and extreme events from recent years. On the measurable phenomena, it does seem that certainly there's been no evidence of overstatement, he said. And it does seem to be a number of points of understatement, and I call that an awful reality because it would be much better if the opposite were true. It would be much better if the evidence was showing the earlier signs had overstated things. Professor Garnaut says the world should have a target for cutting emissions. The conclusions of the review is that it's in Australia's national interest for the world to succeed in holding emissions to 450 parts per million, he said. That's much better than the world being moderately successful at mitigation and holding things to 550. The update comes as the political debate on the government's proposed carbon tax heats up. This week's news poll shows a majority of people are against a price on carbon. Those surveyed were responding to a question on whether they would personally be in favour or against paying more for energy or petrol if it would help slow global warming. Professor Garnaut says there's been a rise in the number of opinion polls and surveys on climate change. He says it's difficult to tie down their statistical significance, but it is clear public confidence has diminished. It's an important question why it seems that in Australia, the United States, and some European countries, confidence in the science has diminished, he said. I can't hold myself as a particular authority on this, but one must presume that as an issue moves from something of purely scientific interest into the subject of political debate and dispute, there's a whole lot of communications comes into play that aren't actually about the science and that will affect people's perception of the science. A CSIRO review found a majority of Australians, between 63 and 83%, believe the climate is changing. But across the surveys, only 50% agreed human activity was driving climate change. If you take our mainstream media, it will often seek to provide some balance between people who base their views on mainstream science and people who don't, he said. That's a very strange sort of balance. It's a balance of numbers of words and not a balance of scientific authority, Professor Garnaut said. Professor Garnaut's next paper will deal with the contentious issue of carbon pricing. The final report will be delivered to the government by the end of May. Yeah, well, you know, I did the show last week, I think, with Mr. Skeptical Science about the evidence for human-caused climate change being overwhelming and how, you know, 98% of active climate scientists agree that humans are the main cause of climate change. And yet it seems that the majority of the Australian population has bought into this pack of bullshit that's being delivered to them by the mainstream media. They just can't see the wood for the trees. And, you know, I have debates and discussions with friends and colleagues about this on a regular basis. And it's so difficult to try and get them to understand the way that science works and to get them to acknowledge and accept that the science for this is overwhelming. There's just no logic in the response of the people who disagree with the scientific consensus on this. It's continually frustrating for me, and I'm always looking for better ways of having discussions and debates with people and trying to get them to understand that scientific consensus is important. Yes, you're always going to have people who disagree with the scientific consensus. That's one of the wonderful things about science and the scientific method. But the way that science works is through consensus. And when you have an overwhelming majority of scientists who agree with the conclusion about something like this, it's absolutely ludicrous and insane not to go with that consensus. And yet, it seems to be the position of over 50%, well over 50% of the Australian population, and I suspect in the US and the UK and other European countries as well. And I don't know what this means for us. Maybe this means that our end is nigh as a species, and the singularity, we don't have 40, 50 years. You know, we'll be dead by tsunamis and floods before the singularity even gets off the ground. Well, staying with science, but moving off of climate change, some interesting research I read this week that's come out of Berkeley, which was actually told to me by my psychiatrist in Melbourne, who was a neuroscientist 5 or 6 years ago, or maybe even a bit longer. And it's about how important sleep is, getting 8 hours of sleep a night, to our ability to learn new things. Now, for many, many years, I slept maybe 4 hours a night. That was my habit through my 20s and into, well into my 30s. And my psychiatrist I was working with explained that the way that our brain takes something from short-term memory and encodes it as long-term memory happens during deep sleep. And if you don't get 8 hours of sleep, you don't get enough deep sleep for that to happen. So you don't learn as well, you become less effective. Here's the latest research from Berkeley. Scientists have long puzzled over the many hours we spend in light, dreamless slumber. But a new study from the University of California, Berkeley, suggests we're busy recharging our brain's learning capacity during this traditionally undervalued phase of sleep, which can take up half the night. UC Berkeley researchers have found compelling evidence that bursts of brain waves, known as sleep spindles, may be networking between key regions of the brain to clear a path to learning. These electrical impulses help to shift fact-based memories from the brain's hippocampus, which has limited storage space, to the prefrontal cortex's hard drive, thus freeing up the hippocampus to take in fresh data. Spindles are fast pulses of electricity generated during non-REM sleep, and they can occur up to 1,000 times a night. All these pieces of the puzzle tell a consistent and compelling story, that sleep spindles predict learning refreshment, said Matthew Walker, Associate Professor of Psychology and Neuroscience at UC Berkeley, and senior author of the study to be published March 8th in the journal Current Biology. The study found that this spindle-driven networking was most likely to happen during stage 2 of non-rapid eye movement NREM sleep, which occurs before we reach the deepest NREM sleep and the dream state known as rapid eye movement REM sleep. This shallow stage of dreamless slumber can account for half our sleeping hours and happens most frequently during the second half of the night, or in the latter part of a period in which we sleep. A lot of the spindle-rich sleep is occurring during second half of the night, so if you sleep 6 hours or less, you are shortchanging yourself. You will have fewer spindles and you might not be able to learn as much, said Bryce Mander, a postdoctoral fellow in psychology at UC Berkeley and lead author of the study. As for broader societal ramifications, researchers said evidence that brain waves during the latter part of the sleep period promote our capacity to store fact-based memories raises the question of whether the early school day is optimal for learning. These findings further highlight the importance of sleep in our educational populations where the need for learning is great, yet late bedtimes and early school start times prevent adequate sleep amounts, Mander said. On average, adults spend one third of their lives sleeping, yet no scientific consensus has been reached on why humans need sleep, Walker said. Previous research led by Walker has shown that a good night's rest helps us regulate our moods and cope with emotional challenges, while sleep deprivation can make otherwise reasonable people emotionally shaky, indicating a strong correlation between sleep loss and psychiatric disorders. So there you have it, folks. Get lots of sleep. Make sure your kids get lots of sleep. And you'll learn better. You'll learn faster. These days, I do try and get 5 or 6 hours. I very rarely would get 8 hours, which probably explains a lot. Sticking with the brain, an interesting article I read in Seed Magazine, seedmagazine.com, by David Weissman, about Buddhism and the brain. I'll skip to the middle. He says, despite my doubts, neurology and neuroscience do not appear to profoundly contradict Buddhist thought. Neuroscience tells us the thing we take as our unified mind is an illusion. Let me read that again. Neuroscience tells us the thing we take as our unified mind is an illusion, that our mind is not unified and can barely be said to exist at all. Our feeling of unity and control is a post hoc confabulation that is easily fractured into separate parts. As revealed by scientific inquiry, what we call a mind or a self or a soul is actually something that changes so much and is so uncertain that our pre-scientific language struggles to find meaning. Buddhists say pretty much the same thing. They believe in an impermanent and illusory self made of shifting parts. They've even come up with language to address the problem between perception and belief. Their word for self is anatta, which is usually translated as non-self. One might try to refer to the self, but the word cleverly reminds oneself that there is no such thing. I won't read the rest of it, but you know, this ties in with what I've been trying to build with Lotu for the last few years. For those of you who've never heard of Lotu, it's my quasi-religion that's built around hard science. And one of the premises of Lotu is that this thing that we think of as me, as the I, as ourself, as the mind, doesn't really exist. It really is an illusion. And of course, this also ties back to free will, which leads me to another story that I want to talk about tonight. I recently listened to an episode of the BBC show In Our Time that's hosted by Melvin Bragg. It's the 500th edition of the program. You can find a link in my show notes. And his guests were Simon Blackburn, Bertrand Russell, Professor of Philosophy at the University of Cambridge, Helen Beebe, Professor of Philosophy at the University of Birmingham, Galen Strawson, Professor of Philosophy at the University of Reading. And they talked about free will. I'll read you the show notes. It says, free will, the extent to which we are free to choose our own actions, is one of the most absorbing philosophical problems debated by almost every great thinker of the last 2,000 years. In a universe apparently governed by physical laws, is it possible for individuals to be responsible for their own actions? Or are our lives simply proceeding along preordained paths? Determinism, the doctrine that every event is the inevitable consequence of what goes before, seems to suggest so. Many intellectuals have concluded that free will is logically impossible. The philosopher Baruch Spinoza regarded it as a delusion. Albert Einstein wrote, human beings in their thinking, feeling, and acting are not free agents, but are as causally bound as the stars in their motion. But in the Enlightenment, philosophers, including David Hume, found ways in which free will and determinism could be reconciled. Recent scientific developments mean that this debate remains as lively today as it was in the ancient world. Now, of course, if you've ever listened to my stuff before on free will, you'll know that I haven't believed in the existence of free will for something like 20 years. It's an absolute fallacy as far as I'm concerned. It's completely unscientific. I basically sum it up by saying decisions are thoughts. Thoughts are properties of the brain. The brain is made of chemicals, and chemicals always obey the laws of chemistry. Therefore, all of our decisions must also obey the laws of chemistry, and they have to be absolutely causal. Now, usually, though, I find that philosophers disagree with that. Philosophers love to try and find ways of supporting free will. However, the interesting thing about this particular show In Our Time, these three philosophers, Simon Blackburn, Helen Beebe, and Galen Strawson, all seem to concur that free will doesn't exist. I highly recommend it. It's an excellent show. I got a little bit frustrated with it, and I'm actually tempted to record the whole thing and record my commentary over the top of it. But generally speaking, I agree with what they're saying. They're a bit fluffy about it. And one of the things that frustrates me the most is they'll talk about my mind and my brain and my actions and my thoughts. The question I want to ask them is, who is this my or the I that you keep referring to? People love to use that word as if I own my brain or I'm the controller of my thoughts, but there is no me that is controlling the brain. It is the brain. When we refer to me, it's really the mind that we're talking about, which is the brain, which operates via chemicals. Anyway, check it out. There's a link in the show notes. In Our Time, Melvin Bragg, the episode on free will. And again, that's part of LOTU, is helping people understand that free will can't possibly exist. And here's the other thing, though. It's not just that it doesn't exist. One of the things that I've been trying to communicate to people for 20 years is the benefits of not believing in free will. It's not a purely theoretical issue. And they bring this up a little bit in this radio show, but they don't drill down into it as much as I would have. The negative emotions that we as humans have, anxiety and fear and anger, are innately tied up with the idea that we and the people around us have free will. So we blame people for their actions, or we feel guilty about our own actions, or we worry about what somebody might do tomorrow or what might happen tomorrow. But when you realize that everything that happens, everything that anyone ever does or ever has done, or everything you've ever done or ever will do, is absolutely governed by the laws of chemistry and the laws of physics, and that the genesis of everything that's ever happened or ever will happen is the Big Bang, and everything that's happening today is just playing out 13 point whatever billion years after the Big Bang. It's atoms bumping into each other because of the laws of physics. A lot of those negative emotions pretty much disappear. It's impossible to feel guilty about something that you did when you realize you had absolutely no control over it. You did what you had to do based on the laws of physics and who you were at the time, how your brain was configured, what your chemical state was. Similarly, you can't be angry for very long at anyone else because you realize that whatever anyone else has ever done to you, they had to do. That was absolutely governed by the laws of physics. Consequently, you don't worry so much about the future because you understand that whatever's going to happen has to happen. And this is determinism, I guess, but I'm talking about scientific determinism. It's not that there's a God or a fate that's playing out. It's the laws of physics playing out. It's the only possible explanation for how the universe works. And when you fully accept that free will can't possibly exist, my experience and the experience of many people I know that don't believe in free will concur that a lot of these negative emotions that we experience just drop off, and life becomes a lot easier and a lot less stressful, a lot less anxiety, a lot less fear, a lot less guilt, because you just understand that things happen the way they absolutely have to happen. I'm going to finish with another story that's got nothing to do with any of those. Getting back to politics, I guess, a little bit in the US. Just to drive home the sort of governments that we have in our wonderful democracy. This is a story about what happened in the US during Prohibition in the 20s. Apparently, during Prohibition, the feds in the United States poisoned alcohol in an effort to stop people from sneakily drinking, and in the process murdered at least 10,000 people. Frustrated that people continued to consume so much alcohol even after it was banned, federal officials had decided to try a different kind of enforcement. They ordered the poisoning of industrial alcohols manufactured in the United States, products regularly stolen by bootleggers and resold as drinkable spirits. Excuse me. The idea was to scare people into giving up illicit drinking. Instead, by the time Prohibition ended in 1933, the federal poisoning program, by some estimates, had killed at least 10,000 people. Although mostly forgotten today, the chemist's war of prohibition remains one of the strangest and most deadly decisions in American law enforcement history. As one of its most outspoken opponents, Charles Norris, the chief medical examiner of New York City during the 1920s, liked to say it was our national experiment in extermination. Poisonous alcohol still kills. 16 people died just this month after drinking lethal booze in Indonesia, where bootleggers make their own brews to avoid steep taxes. But that's due to unscrupulous businessmen rather than government order. You find the show notes, this story in the show notes. It's from a website called the Anti-Fascist Encyclopedia, which has a lot of interesting articles. The thing that I find a couple of things interesting about this. One is that, you know, the so-called wonderful Western democracies would do something like this. Secondly, that it's kind of been forgotten about and written out of history. But thirdly, because we're heading into another prohibition, and it's a prohibition of tobacco. There's some news came out in the last couple of days that New Zealand intends to fully outlaw all smoking of tobacco by 2025. And the way things are going in Australia and the United States, it looks like we're headed in a similar direction. It's prohibition again. Now, what amazes me is how we don't learn. Prohibition of alcohol in the 20s didn't work. Prohibition of so-called drugs, you know, illicit drugs like marijuana and ecstasy, heroin and cocaine over the last 50, 60 years obviously haven't worked. And yet we're staring down the barrel of prohibition of tobacco, which absolutely won't work. Prohibition never works. I just hope that they don't start poisoning our tobacco supply, because I enjoy my cigars too much. That's the show for tonight. Thanks for listening. Check out the company that now funds TPN, suave.com.au, my other little business. And I'll be back hopefully sometime in the next week, maybe with Rod, talking about the dangers or lack thereof of nuclear energy and the news of the week. Cheers.